You have given us much to ponder. Seagal was more subdued. Some of the intelligence is bitter indeed, but we will think on it. Eventually, we will make our decision. Madame Gudrian now stepped forward and resumed her role of leader. Her voice was firm, her color had returned.
Mighty Seagal, there is still the matter of our mission, our request of you.
The exotic clenched his fist, which still held Yochi's message. The vellum crackled.
Ah, your request. This royal command was useless, you know. Yochi has no power here, but doubtless he did not care to admit it to you. I allowed you to enter our territory on a whim, curious as to the extremity that would make you take such a risk. We had planned to amuse ourselves with you before finally permitting you to die.
And now, Madame inquired,
what do you ask of us?
We seek a river, a very large one, rising in this area, which flows eastward until it reaches the great half-salty lagoons of the Loch Mer, hundreds of kilometers from here. We hope to travel upon this river to the site of the ship's grave.
There was a surprised chorus of howls.
We know the river, Seagal said. It is the Yastral, a truly mighty flood. We have a few legends of the ship. Early in the history of our people on this world, we broke away from the main body of the Fervalog and sought independence in these mountains, away from the hunting and the senseless annual slaughter of the Grand Combat.
Madame had to explain carefully the human complicity in the recent rise to dominance of the Tanu, as well as her own scheme to restore the old balance of power while freeing humanity.
But to do this, we must obtain certain ancient items from the crater of the ship's grave. If you will furnish us with a guide to the river, we believe that we will be able to locate the crater.
And this plan, when will you put it into effect? When might the human scientists be free of the Tanu yoke and able, if Te wills, to help us?
We had hoped to implement the scheme this year before the start of the Grand Combat Truce, but there is scant hope of this now. Only 12 days remain. The ship's grave lies at least 200 kilometers from here. It will doubtless take us half of the remaining time just to walk to the head of navigation on the river.
That is not so, Seagal said. He called out, Calipin!
The Boggle stepped forth from the throng. His formerly surly face was transfigured by a broad smile.
Master? I do not understand these kilometers. Tell the humans how it is with the Yastral.
Below these mountains, the Boggle said, are the caverns where we make our homes. But at other levels, some deeper, some shallower, are the water caves. They are a maze of springs, bottomless pools, and streams flowing through the blackness. Several rivers have their sources in the water caves. The Paradise, which flows past Fenaya to the northwest, is one. But the mightiest torrent born beneath our mountains is the Yastral.
Claude exclaimed, he could be right. There were underground tributaries to the Danube, even in our own time. Some said they came from Lake Constance. Others postulated a connection to the Rhine.
The Boggle said, the Yastral emerges as a full-grown river into a great lowland to the northeast. If you enter the water caves at Aliki's shaft via the lift buckets, you can pick up the dark Yastral not 2 hours' march from here. Then it is a subterranean water journey of but a single day to the bright Yastral, that which flows beneath the open sky.
Madame asked Seagal, would your boatman guide us along the underground section?
Seagal did not speak. He lifted his eyes to the surrounding crowd of monstrosities. There was a musical chorus of howls. The goblin shapes began to shift and change, and the terrible swirling pattern of the sky calmed. The mental energies of the little people relaxed from the projection of undisciplined hatred and self-loathing, and began to weave gentler illusions. The dreadful deformities faded. A throng of miniature men and women took the place of the nightmares.
Send them, sighed the howling ones.
Seagal bowed his head in acknowledgement.
It will be done.
He arose and lifted his hand.
All of the small people repeated the gesture. They became as tenuous as mountain mist burning away in the noon sunlight.
"Remember us," they said as they vanished. "Remember us."
"We will," Madame whispered.
The Boggle went trotting away, beckoning for them to follow.
Claude took Madame Guderian's arm, and Richard, Martha, and Felice came trailing behind.
"Only one thing," the old woman said to Claude in a low tone. "What did he really look like, this Seagal?"
"You can't read my mind, Angelique."
"You know I cannot."
"Then you'll never know. And I wish to God," the old man added, "that I didn't."
6. Late in the evening, when the giant hawk moths and the flying squirrels played their aerial games above the wooded canyon of Hidden Springs Village, 7 men, bearing 6 heavy sacks, came home to the low-life settlement, led by Khalid Khan. They sought Uwe Guldenzopf, but his hut was empty. Callistro, the goat boy, bringing his animals home from their browsing, informed the 7 that Uwe was at the community bathhouse with Chief Burke.
"The chief is here?" Khalid exclaimed in consternation. "Then the expedition to the ship's grave was a failure?" Callistro shook his head. He was about 5 years old, sober and responsible enough to know something of the great plans that were afoot.
"The chief was hurt, so he came back. Sister Amory fixed his wounded leg, but he still must soak it many times each day."
"What do you have in the sacks?"
The men laughed. Khalid dropped his load on the ground with a loud clanging sound.
"Treasure!"
The speaker was a wiry, shock-haired individual standing just behind Khalid, the only one of the 7 not burdened down. The stump of his left arm was wrapped in a wad of dark-stained cloth.
"Let me see,"
begged the child, but the men were already on their way up the flat-floored canyon. Callistro hurried his animals into their night pen and rushed to follow.
White starlight shone on a small area of open grass near the banks of the brook that was born of the hot and cold springs mingling. However, most of the village lay concealed in deep shadow, the homes and community buildings sheltered beneath tall pines or spreading evergreen oaks that hid them from Frenaya's Tanu sky searchers. The bathhouse, a large log structure with a low-eaved roof overgrown with vines, was built against one of the canyon walls. Its windows were closely shuttered, and a U-shaped passage kept torchlight from the interior from shining out the open door. Khalid and his men entered into a scene of steamy cheerfulness. It seemed that half the village had gathered in here on this rather chilly evening. Men, women, and a few children splashed in stone-lined hot or cold pools, lulled in hollow log soaking tubs, or simply lounged about gossiping or playing backgammon or card games. Uwe Guldenzopf's voice rang out over the communal din.
"Hoi, look who's back home again!" And the lowlives raised a shout of welcome. Somebody yelled, "Beer!" And one of Khalid's grimy contingent appended a heartfelt, "Food!"
The boy Callistro was sent to roust out the village victuallers, while the new arrivals pushed through a gabbling, laughing mob toward an isolated tub where Pio Pio Mox Mox Burke sat, his long, graying hair stringy in the bathhouse vapors, and his craggy face at which, as he suppressed, a delighted grin.
"How?" quoth he.
"Beats me," the Pakistani metalsmith replied. "But we did it."
He dropped a sack on the stone floor and opened it, taking out a lance head rough from the casting mold.
"Secret weapon? Mark one."
Turning to one of the other men, he groped in his sack and produced a handful of smaller objects, approximately leaf-shaped.
"Mark two. You sharpen them? They're arrowheads. We've got about 220 kilos of iron all told, some of it cast like these, some in bars for miscellanea, ready for forging. What we have here is medium carbon steel smelted in the best antique style. We built us a force-draft furnace fueled with charcoal and drafted with 6 skin bellows hooked up to a decamaltouillère, carbon from charred bulrushes. We buried the furnace so we can go back and make more iron when we've a mind to."
Burke's eyes glistened.
"Ah, Micaiah. Well done, Khalid.
And the rest of you too, Sigmund, Denny, Langstone, Gert, Smokey, Ami. Well done, all of you. This could be the breakthrough we've all been dreaming of, praying for.
Whether or not the others succeed at the ship's grave, this iron will give us a fighting chance against the Tano for the first time.
Uva stood sucking his meerschaum, his gaze wandering over the tattered and soot-stained smelters.
"And what happened," he inquired, "to the other three of you?"
The grins of the men disappeared. Khalid said,
"Bob and Venti stayed too long one evening at the ore pit. When we came to check on them, they were gone. We never saw a trace of them again. Prince Francesco was off hunting for the pot when the howlers nailed him."
"They let us have him back, though,"
said the skinny, hatchet-faced man named Smokey.
"Day later, poor Frankie came staggering back into Camp Starkers. They'd blinded and gelded him and cut off his hands, and then really got down to business with hot pitch. His mind was gone, of course. Small hope the howlers blunked him before they had their fucking fun and games."
"Suffering Christ," growled Uva.
"We got a bit back,"
Denny offered. His black face flashed a wry smile.
"You did," said the bandy-legged little Singhalese man named Homi.
He explained to Chief Burke.
"On our way home, a howler came at us in broad daylight, oh, maybe 40 kilometers down the Moselle from here, all dressed up in his bloody monster suit like a great winged naga with two heads. Denny let him have an iron-tipped arrow in the guts, and he went down like a rotten willow tree. And would you believe, all that was left was this hunchbacked dwarf with a face like a stoat."
The men grunted in reminiscence, and a couple of them whacked Denny on the back. The latter said,
"At least we know now that the iron works on both kinds of exotics, right? I mean, the howlers are nothing but screwed-up fervalog. So if our noble spook allies ever forget who their friends are..."
There were murmurs of agreement and a few quiet laughs. Chief Burke said,
"It's a point to keep in mind. Although God knows we need Fervalog help to bring off Madame's plan against Fenaya. The little people were agreeable to the original scheme, but I'm afraid adding iron to the equation might give them second thoughts."
"Just wait till they see us take out some Tano with the iron," Smokey said confidently. "Just wait till we equalize things with them dog-collar some bitches. Why, the damn Fervalog will kiss our feet. Or bums. Or something."
Everybody roared. An excited young voice from among the crowd of villagers shouted,
"Why should we hold back on the Tano until Fenaya? There's a caravan going to Castle Gateway in 2 days. Let's sharpen up some arrows and bag us an exalted one right away."
A few of the others yelled approval, but Chief Burke hauled himself out of his bath like an enraged bull alligator and yelled,
"Simmer down, you turkey turd slangers! Nobody touches this iron without permission from me. It has to be kept secret. You want the whole Tano chivalry on our necks? Beltane would send out a screech like a goosed moose if we tipped our hand. He might bring in Nodon, even call for reinforcements from the south."
They mumbled at this. The aggressive youngster called out,
"When we use iron in the Fenaya attack, they'll know. Why not now?"
"Because," Burke drawled, in the sarcastic tone he had once used to freeze the collops of inept fledgling advocates, "the attack on Fenaya will come just prior to the truce for the Grand Combat. None of the other Tano will pay much attention to Voltaine's troubles then. You know the way these exotics' minds work. Nothing but nothing gets in the way of preparations for the glorious Shemazel. 2 or 3 days before truce, when we hope to strike, not a Tano on Earth will come to the aid of Fenaya. Not even to help their pals, not even to save their barium mine, not even to beat back humans armed with iron. They'll all be hot to head south to the big game."
The crowd fell back to palaver over the amazing single-mindedness of the exotic sportsman, and Burke began to get dressed. Uva waggishly suggested that the Tanu were nearly as bad as the Irish for loving a fight without considering the long-view consequences. There was universal laughter at this, and not a single son nor daughter of Erin's Isle rose to defend the racial honor. The thought flashed into Burke's mind that there was a reason for this, and he ought to know what it was. But at the same moment, Khalid Khan caught sight of the red man's healing wound.
Masala Pio, you did scratch yourself up a bit, didn't you?
Burke's left leg was hideously indented at the calf by a purplish-red scar over 20 cents in length. He grunted.
Souvenir of a one-horned chozer. It killed Steffi, and damn near did it for me by the time Pegleg schlepped me back here to Amarie. Galloping septicemia, but she caught it. Looks like hell, but I can walk, even run, if I care to pay the price.
Uva reminded him. The meeting of the steering committee, tonight. Khalid should come.
Right. But first we have to see to the needs of this gang. How about it, men? Food and drinks on the way? But is there anything else we can do for you now?
Khalid said.
Sigmund's hand. Aside from our three debtors, he's the only casualty.
What happened? Burke asked.
Sigmund sheepishly hid his stump.
Ah, I was stupid. Giant salamander sprang at me, fanged me right in the palm. You know, there's only one thing to do, the way their venom works.
Sig was bringing up the rear, Danny said. All of a sudden we missed him. When we went back to investigate, there he was, putting on a tourniquet, cool as you please, with his Vitrador axe and his mitt lying on the ground beside him.
You come along with us to Amarie's place, the chief said. We'll have her check it out.
Ah, oh, it's all right, chief. We put plenty of AB and Progen on it.
Shut your pisk and come along, the chief turned to the others. The rest of you boys relax and eat and have a couple of days' sleep. There'll be a big council of war, a contingent one anyhow, inside of a week, when the volunteers from the other settlements start showing up. We'll need you to work on this iron when we get the blacksmith shop set up someplace where the Firvelog won't spot it. Till then, I'll take charge of the stuff. Put it out of temptation's reach. Then Burke raised his voice so that the entire bathhouse could hear him. All of you, if you value your own lives, and if you give a damn about the liberty of humans who are still enslaved, forget about what you've seen and heard here tonight.
A breath of assent rose from the assemblage. The chief nodded and hoisted two of the heavy sacks. Khalid and Uva dragged away the other four and they moved out of the bathhouse trailed by Sigmund.
The meeting is at Madame's cottage as usual, Burke told the metalsmith as he limped along. Amarie's living there now. We put her on the committee by acclamation.
Uva said,
That nunny is some medic. She shrank Maxel so we don't have to keep him locked up anymore. And poor Sandra, no more suicidal threats now that the fungus is cured. And there's Haim's eyelid all rebuilt, and she healed that big mother of an ulcer on old man Kawai's foot.
That'll make for quieter meetings, Khalid remarked. One less thing for the old boy to complain about. This nun sounds like a handy lady to have around.
The chief chuckled. I didn't even mention the way she cleaned up 16 cases of worms and almost all the jungle rot. Madame might have to do some fancy politicking in the next election if she wants to hold on to the free leadership of this gang of outlaws.
It never struck me that she relished the honor, Khalid was acerbic, any more than you did when you were in the hot seat.
They plodded along, making almost no sound on the path that wound beneath the sheltering trees. The long canyon had many little dead-end tributaries from which the numerous springs debouched. Most of the cottages had been built close to these natural water supplies. There were some 30 homes altogether, in which dwelt 85 human beings, who made up the largest low-life settlement in the known Pliocene world. The four men crossed a rill on stepping stones and headed up one of the rocky clefts to where a distinctive little house stood under a huge pine. The cottage was not built like the others of prosaic logs or wattle and daub, but of neatly mortared stone, washed white with lime, and reinforced with dark half-timbering. It was eerily evocative of a certain elder-world dwelling in the hills above Lyon. Madame's rose cuttings, nourished by the manure of mastodons, had burgeoned into rampant climbers that all but smoothed the thatched roof in blossoms. The night air was heavy with their perfume. The men came up the path, then halted. Standing in their way was a tiny animal. Stiff-legged, its oversized eyes gleaming, it growled.
Hey, Deej, Burke laughed. It's just us, Pupika, friends.
The little cat growled louder.
the low rumble moving up the scale to become a threatening howl. It stood its ground. Chief Burke put down his burden and knelt with one hand outstretched. Khalid Khan stepped behind Sigmund, a memory of a terrible suspicion crowding to the fore of his mind. A memory of a rainy night inside a tree when the cat had growled like this before. A suspicion of a valued companion who had been too good a woodsman to be surprised by the relatively sluggish attack of a giant salamander. Khalid slipped open the mouth of his sack just as the cottage door swung wide to show Amaree's veiled figure, silhouetted against dim lamplight.
Deja?
The nun called, rattling her rosary beads in what was evidently some signal. She caught sight of the man.
Oh, it's you, Chief. And Khalid, you're back. But what?
The turbaned metalsmith seized the hair of the one they had called Sigmund. With his other hand, he pressed something gray and hard against the man's throat.
Do not move, Sorkavaj, or you're dead, even as your brother before you!
Amaree screamed, and Uva uttered an obscenity. For Khalid was suddenly struggling with a gorgon. Instead of hair, the Pakistani clutched writhing little vipers growing from Sigmund's scalp. These struck, sinking tiny fangs into flesh that puffed up, throbbed, as quasi-deadly venom flooded the blood vessels and went racing toward Khalid's heart.
Stop, I say!
Roared the anguished smith. Involuntarily, his right arm tightened, driving the dull point of the iron lance blank into the soft hollow below the monster's voice box. The thing emitted a gurgling squeal and went limp. Khalid sprang away from the falling body, dropping the iron. It hit the earth with a dull thud and came to rest close beside the dead shape-changer. Amaree and the three men stared down at the creature, which could have weighed no more than 20 or 30 kilos. Flattened little dugs identified it as a female. Its bald cranium was monstrously compressed just above the eyes, and elongated backward into a triangular bony collar. It had a mere hole for a nose, and a massive lower jaw with loose peg-like teeth. The body was almost globular, with limbs spiderishly thin, and the left forepaw missing.
It's not a Fearfulog,
Amaree managed to say.
A howler, Burke told her. Some biologists believe they're a Fearfulog mutation. Each one is supposed to have a different true shape, all hideous.
You see what she was trying to do, don't you?
Khalid's voice was shaking from reaction and chagrin. He felt his left hand, which was now completely normal.
She saw us kill her mate with iron, and had to find out what the new weapon was. So she must have crept up on Sigmund as he marched at the end of the line, and she took his place. Cut off her hand so she wouldn't have to carry the iron.
But they've never masqueraded as humans,
Uva exclaimed. What could have been its motive?
Look at her. Dressed in rags, Amaree said.
She knelt down in the light from the doorway to examine the goblin body. One of the howler's crude skin boots had dropped off in the struggle, exposing a humanoid foot, miniaturized but as perfectly formed as that of a child. There was a pathetic blister at the heel. Evidently the little being had had to hurry to keep pace with the faster humans. The nun replaced the boot, straightened the pipe-stem legs, closed the glazed eyes.
She was very poor. Perhaps she hoped to discover information valuable enough to sell.
To the normal Fearvalog? Burke suggested.
Or to the Tano.
The nun got up and dusted the front of her white habit. Khalid said,
There might be others. Others who watched us at the smeltery. If this one could change to human shape, how will we ever be sure?
Burke picked up the iron blade, grasped the metalsmith's arm, and drew the rough lance head across the skin. A few drops of dark blood sprang from the abrasion.
You're real enough, anyhow. I'll go test the rest of the crew right away. Later we'll work out something a little less crude, pinprick maybe.
He limped away toward the bathhouse. Uva and Khalid hauled the precious bags of iron into the rose-covered cottage, then returned to where Amaree stood over the body. She held the cat, which was still gently growling.
What shall we do with her, sister? Khalid inquired.
Amaree sighed.
I have a large basket. Perhaps you can put her in the springhouse for me.
I'm afraid I'll have to dissect her tomorrow.
As the steering committee waited for Chief Burke to return to the cottage, the Vidler and Chief offered samples of a new beverage.
We took some of that lousy raw wine of Perkins and steeped this little forest wildflower in it.
Everybody sipped. Amari said,
"That's nice, Marielena."
Uwe said something in German under his breath.
"You know what you've done, woman? You've reinvented May wine."
"That's it, that's it,"
old man Kawai piped. He was only 86, but since he had declined rejuvenation on a matter of principle, he resembled an unwrapped oriental mummy.
"Most refreshing, my dear. Now if we can only produce a decent sake."
The cottage door opened and Peo Peo Mox Mox Burke stooped to enter. The other committee member sat stark still until the red man gave a nod.
"They were all kosher. I tested not only the smelters, but all the rest of the folks in the bathhouse as well."
"Thank heaven," said the architect in chief. "What a thought. Shape-changers infiltrating our people."
He wagged his neatly trimmed mutton chops, managing to look like an accountant who had discovered that a valued client was cooking the books.
"Neither Firvelad nor Howlers had any reason to try this trick before," the chief warned. "But now, with the attack coming up, and the iron as a maybe not-so-secret weapon, we're going to have to be alert for other attempts. When the volunteers start arriving, every single one must be tested, and we'll test all participants before every important meeting or briefing."
"My responsibility," said Uwe, who was hunting and public safety.
"Whip me up some needles, Khalid?"
"As soon as I can get the forge hot tomorrow."
The chief took his place with the other 7 committee members around the table.
"All right, let's get this over as quickly as possible so Khalid can get some rest. As deputy free leader, I call this meeting of the steering committee to order. Old business. Structures. Let's have it, Philemon."
"The huts at the Rhine staging area have been completed," said the architect. "Everything is ready there except the main shelter pavilion. The boys will have the Hidden Springs visitor dorm ready in another 2 or 3 days."
"Good," said the chief. "Public Works. Vanda Joe."
A taffy-haired woman, with the face of a Madonna and the voice of a drill sergeant, spoke up.
"We finished the mask trail from here to the staging area. 106 bloody kilometers invisible from the air, corduroyed the last 2 kloms through the swamp, and don't think that wasn't a bitch. Still putting up the thorn bomber around the staging camp to keep most of the critters out and the recruits in."
"How about the launching ramps?"
"Decided on pontoons. Inflated skins and boarding. Put them up at the last minute. Peg Leg and his lads are contributing the skins."
"Good. Hunting and public safety?"
"Nothing much new from me," Uwe said. "Most of my people are working with Vonda Joe or Phil. I've liaised with the commissary at Ivrazel to help with quantities of game and staples when the extra bods start arriving. And we've set up a procedure for processing new arrivals here at Hidden Springs before sending them to the river."
"Sounds okay. Domestics?"
Old man Kawai pursed his scored lips.
"There is no way we can come up with more than 100 boiled leather hard hats and chest guards by D-Day. You know how long it takes to shape and dry that stuff, even with the forms filled with hot sand. The volunteers are just going to have to go mostly bare-ass, unless you want our people deprived. Dushimasho, I've done my best, but I'm no miracle man."
"The shortage can't be helped," Burke said soothingly.
"How about the camouflage nets?"
"We'll be putting the big one in position tomorrow, just in case they get back early with the exotic flyer."
The wizened ancient threw an anxious glance at the chief.
"Do you really think they've got a chance, Peo?"
"Not much of one," Burke admitted. "But we won't give up hope until the last hour before the truce. Human services."
"Linen bandages ready," Amari said. "We're assembling stores of oil and alcohol and all of the AB we can scrape up. 15 fighters have been rough trained as frontline medics."
She paused, her face furrowed with determination.
"I want you to change your mind about having me accompany the fighters, Peo. For the love of God, when will they need me more than in a battle?"
The Native American shook his head.
You're the only doctor we have, probably the only one in the low-life world. We can't have you at risk. There's the future to think about. If we do liberate Fenaya, we may be able to detorque other medical people. If we fail, and the troops come across the Rhine to our staging area, it may be a long time until the next war. Our fighters will tend their own injuries. You stay here.
The nun sighed.
Industry, said Burke.
We brought back 220 kilos of iron, Khalid said. 4 of our men died. We have enough experienced people left to begin final work on the weapons as soon as we get some sleep.
There were somber congratulations all around. Provisioning?
We've enough stored here to feed 500 people for 2 weeks, Marielena said. That does not include the 5 tons of instant rations we'll distribute to fighters going down to camp. You don't want any cooking going on down by the Rhine, where the Tana might spot the smoke.
She pulled a handkerchief from the sleeve of her pink and yellow gown and mopped her ample brow.
Those poor souls are going to curse pemmican and parched bulrush roots before this thing is over.
If that's all they curse, Burke said, they'll be lucky. All right, that leaves my report. Warlord in chief. I've received word from Palal, the Fervalog Generalissimo, that his forces will hold themselves combat-ready for the last 3 days in September. Under optimal circumstances, we'll mount the attack before dawn on the 29th, which will give us nearly 2 full fighting days before the truce officially begins on October 1st at sunrise. After that, we humans will be on our own, and Fenaya better be ready for mop-up. I'll have more details on plans of attack at the War Council later. Okay? Now, new business. We'll consider the matter of the Howler spy as already introduced and sent to public safety for action.
The final preparation of the iron weapons, Khalid said. My men will soundproof one of the vented caves and turn it into a smithy. I'll need some help from Phil's people.
More new business?
We will need more alcoholic drink, Marielena said. Mead or beer from the Fervalog. I can't have the volunteers swilling our young wines.
Burke chuckled. Perish the thought. Uwe, will you sound out the Hyvrazel people on that?
Check.
Any more new business? Amory hesitated.
Perhaps it's too soon to bring this up, but there is the matter of the second phase of Madame's plan.
Hi, cried Old Man Kauai.
If Fenaya is a success, Madame will want to send others south immediately.
Philemon was uneasy.
We'll do well to accomplish even a small part of the first phase of Madame's plan, much less the other two. I say leave this to Madame to work out when she returns. It's her scheme. Perhaps she and that wild little person Felice will have worked something out.
Caracoles, grumbled Marielena. I must consider the later phases, even if the rest of you shirk your responsibility. If our people must go south without proper provisions, it is I who receive the cowchip bouquet.
Ah, I'll do what I can.
Thank you, Carida, the chief said peaceably. I'll talk with you tomorrow about a possible division of rations. But I think that's the best we can do for now on phase 2 or 3 planning. There are too many unknown factors.
Such as, who will survive Fenaya? Wailed Old Man Kauai. Or if we even mount the Fenaya attack in the first place.
Vonda Joe slapped one hand on the table.
Tails up! No defeatism allowed. We're going to hit those high-pocket bastards like they've never been hit before. And Khalid, I've got dibbies on one iron arrowhead, if you please. There's a certain Tanu stud on the other side of the Rhine whose ass belongs to me.
If you're sure that one will do it, the metalsmith laughed.
Order, Burke muttered. Chair will entertain a motion to table strategy planning for the grand combat.
So move, said Amory. It was quickly affirmed and seconded.
Any more new business? The chief asked.
Silence.
Move adjournment, said Old Man Kauai. Past my bedtime.
Second, said Uva.
And the steering committee meeting came to an end. Everyone except Chief Burke bade Amory good night and slipped away into the shadows. The quondam judge stretched out his wounded leg for the nun to examine. At length she said,
There's nothing more I can do for you, Pio. Hot soaks and moderate exercise to keep the muscles from tightening. I can give you a Herrendorf to block the pain on D-Day.
He waved a deprecating hand. We'll save it for somebody who really needs it.
As you like. They went outside, where the village was quiet except for faint insect noises. It was nearly midnight and the moon was still down. Burke craned his neck and studied the starry vault of the sky.
There it is, just above the rim of the canyon, he said, pointing.
What? She inquired.
Ah, I forgot you were a newcomer, Amory. The constellation we call the Trumpet. See the triangular bell? The four bright stars forming the straight tube? Take special note of the Mouthpiece Star. It's the most important one in all the sky, at least to the Tanu and Firvalag. On the day when it culminates at midnight over Fania and Hivrazel, those are the oldest exotic settlements, remember, it will mark the opening of the 5-day Grand Combat.
The date?
By our milieu calendar, around October 31st or November 1st.
You're kidding.
It's true. And the noon culmination that takes place exactly 6 months later comes around May Day. The exotics have another big show then, which Tanu and Firvalag celebrate separately. The Grand Love Feast. Most popular with the females of the species, it said.
That's really very odd, Amory said. I'm no folklorist, but those two dates...
I know. Only in our time there was no good explanation, in astronomy or anything else, for the ritualization of those days rather than any others occurring about the same times.
It's ridiculous to assume a correlation.
Oh, certainly.
The Native American's face was inscrutable in the starlight. I mean, 6 million years.
Do you know the significance of the Mouthpiece Star? It's a marker. Their home galaxy lies almost directly behind the star.
Oh, Pale. How many light years?
A hell of a lot more than 6 million. So in one way, they've come even farther away from home than we have. Poor devils.
He gave her a brief salute and limped away, leaving her standing beneath the stars. 7.
But it isn't blue, Felice protested. It's brown.
Madame changed the course of their dinghy to avoid a stranded snag.
The color brown, it lacks that certain cachet. The composer wished to evoke the river's beauty.
The girl gave a contemptuous snort as she studied the terrain. This place would never win any prizes. Too dry. It looks like it hasn't rained for months.
She knelt upright in the bow of the little boat and scanned the open dun-colored slopes with the aid of Madame Gudrian's little monocular. Only in the arroyos and in the flats nearest the Danube were there areas of green. The widely scattered groves of trees had a dusty bluish look. I can see a few small herds of hipparions and antelopes, the girl said after a time. Nothing else seems to be alive in those uplands on the left bank. No sign of the crater. Nothing distinctive at all except that little volcano yesterday. You don't think we could have passed it by, do you? This damn river really rolls.
Richard will tell us at noon. The old woman and the athlete had shared one decimal boat since the party had emerged from the water caves nearly 2 days ago. Claude, Martha, and Richard occupied a second boat that drifted a few dozen meters ahead of them on the swift current of the bright Estral. In spite of the drought, they had made splendid time since the flood received most of its water from the Alps, which shone white in the far south. On the previous night, they had pulled up on a wooded gravel bar to sleep, the bogle having warned them against camping on shore. They were grateful for their isolation when they were awakened later by the cries of hyenas. Claude told them that some of the Pliocene species attained the bulk of large bears and were active predators as well as scavengers. For navigation, they had one precious map. Back at the tree, Richard had traced pertinent portions from the fading plas of a venerable Kummerly and Fry Strassenkarte von Europa, Zweite Außenjahrge Ausgabe, which a nostalgic lowlife treasured as his dearest memento of times to come.
The old road map was dim and difficult to decipher, and Claude had warned Richard that the watershed of the Pliocene Danube was going to be greatly altered during the coming ice age by volumes of glacial till washing down from the Alps. The tributary streams of the upper Danube that were shown on the map would likely occupy different positions during the Pliocene, and the bed of the great river itself would lie farther south, twisted all out of recognition. The travelers could not hope to follow Galactic Age landmarks to the Rees Crater. But there was one precious bit of data from the old map that would have retained its validity over 6 million years. The exact longitudinal component in kilometers between the meridian of High Vrazel Peak, alias Grand Ballon, and that of the Rees, symbolized on the map by the future city of Nordlingen, which lay within what would be a mere ringwall plain on the Elder Earth. No matter how the Istral wandered, it was still bound to cross the Rees Meridian. As nearly as Richard had been able to determine from the decrepit plas of the road map, the linear distance was 260 kilometers, 3.5 degrees of longitude east of the prime meridian of High Vrazel. Richard had set his accurate wrist chronometer for precisely noon at High Vrazel, and had carefully improvised a quadrant to measure the solar angle. Every clear day, the quadrant could be used to tell them local noontime, and the difference between this and PM noon shown on the watch could be used to calculate the longitude. When they reached the Rees Meridian on the Danube, all they had to do was march due north to reach the crater. One of the figures in the lead boat raised an arm. The craft pulled in to shore.
"There's a little break in the northern highlands there," Felice said. "Maybe Richard has decided it's our best bet."
When they had beached their boat next to the other one, she asked,
"What do you think, guys? Is this it?"
"Pretty close, anyhow," Richard said, "and it doesn't look like too bad a hike, for all it's uphill. I calculate 30 kilometers north should hit the lower rim. Even if I'm a little off, we should be able to see the thing from the crest of those northern hills. Damn crater's supposed to be more than 20 kilometers wide, after all. How about lunch while I set up one more sunshot?"
"I've got fish," Martha said, raising a string of silvery brown shapes. "Richard's excused for his navigating chores, and that leaves you two to dig the Persian bulrushes, while Madame and I get these to grilling."
"Right," sighed Claude and Felice. They made their fire in a well-shaded spot near the edge of a large grove. Clear water came trickling down a limestone ledge to disappear into a muddy depression that swarmed with little yellow butterflies. After 15 minutes or so, the delectable smell of roasting young salmon came wafting to the tuber grubbers.
"Come on, Claude," Felice said, sloshing a net full of lumps up and down in the water to rinse them. "We've got enough of these things."
The paleontologist stood quietly, up to his knees in the river among the tall stalks.
"I thought I heard something. Probably beavers."
They waded back to the bank where they had left their boots. Both pairs were still there, but something, or someone, had been messing about with them.
"Look here," said Claude, studying the surrounding mud.
"Baby footprints," Felice exclaimed. "Screw me blind. Could there be howlers or fearvalog in this country?"
They hurried back to the fire with the tubers. Madame used her far-sensing metafunction to scan the area and professed to sense no exotic beings.
"It is doubtless some animal," she said, "with prints that mimic those of children. A small bear, perhaps."
"Bears were very rare during the early Pliocene," Claude said. "More likely..." "Ah, well, whatever it is, it's too small to do us any harm."
Richard came back to the group and tucked map, note plaque, and quadrant back into his pack.
"We're near as damn all," he said. "If we really hump this afternoon, we might get there fairly early tomorrow."
"Sit down and have some fish," Martha said. "Doesn't the aroma drive you wild? They say that salmon is just about the only fish that's nutritionally complete enough to serve as a steady diet, because it has fat as well as protein, you see." She licked her lips, then gave a strangled squeak.
"Don't turn around."
Her eyes were wide. The rest of them were sitting on the side of the fire opposite her.
"Right behind you, there's a wild Rama."
"No, Felice," Claude hissed, as the athlete's muscles automatically tensed. "It's harmless. Everybody turn very slowly," Martha said.
"It's carrying something."
The little creature, its body covered with golden tan fur, stood a short distance back among the trees.
trembling noticeably, but with an expression of what could only be called determination upon its face. It was about the size of a 6-year-old child and had fully humanoid hands and feet. It carried 2 large warty fruits, greenish bronze, streaked with dull orange. As the 5 travelers regarded it with astonishment, the Ramapithecine stepped forward, placed the fruits on the ground, then drew back. With infinite caution, Claude rose to his feet. The little ape backed up a few paces. Claude said softly,
"Well, hello there, Mrs. Thing. We're glad you could stop by for lunch. How's the husband and kiddies? All well? A little hungry in this drought? I'm not surprised. Fruit is nice, but there's nothing like a bit of protein and fat to keep body and soul together. And the mice and squirrels and locusts have mostly migrated into the upper valleys, haven't they? Too bad you didn't go along with them."
He stooped and picked up the fruits. What were they? Melons? Some kind of pawpaw? He carried them back to the fire and took 2 of the larger salmon and wrapped them in an elephant ear leaf. He put the fish down on the exact spot where the fruit had been and withdrew to his place by the fire. The Ramapithecus stared at the bundle. She reached out, touched a greasy fish head, and put the finger into her mouth. Giving a low crooning call, she everted her upper lip. Felice grinned back. She drew her dirk, hefted one of the fruits, and sliced it open. A mouth-watering, sweet smell arose from the yellowish-pink flesh. Felice cut off a tiny slice and took a bite of it. "Yum!" The Rama clucked. She picked up the package of fish, everted her lips over her small teeth once again, and ran into the trees. Felice called out, "Give her regards to King Kong!"
"That was the damnedest thing," Richard said. "Smart, aren't they?" "Our direct hominid ancestors," Claude stirred up the tubers.
"We had them for servants in Phanaya," Martha said. "They were very gentle and cleanly little things, timid, but they would work conscientiously at the tasks given them by torque wearers."
"How were they cared for?" Claude asked, curious. "Like little people?"
"Not really," Martha said. "They had a kind of barn adjacent to the house where they lived in partitioned stalls, almost like small cave rooms filled with straw. They were monogamous, you see, and each family had to have its own apartment. There were community areas, too, and dormitory nooks for the singletons. The childless adults worked for about 12 hours, then came home to eat and sleep. The mothers would care for their young for 3 years and then put them in charge of aunties, old females who acted for all the world like school teachers. The aunties and other very old males and females played with the children and cared for them when the parents were absent. You could see that the parents were unhappy at having to leave the little ones, but the call of the torque couldn't be denied. Still, the Rama keepers told me that the ante system was a variant of one used by the creatures in the wild. It generally produced well-adjusted individuals. The Tano have raised Ramas in captivity for as long as they've lived on this planet."
"Those sounds they make," Claude said. "Could ordinary, bare-necked people such as yourself communicate with them?"
Martha shook her head. "They answered to their names, and there were perhaps a dozen simple voice commands they'd respond to, but the principal means of communicating with them was through the torque. They could grasp very complex mental commands, and of course they were trained with the pleasure-pain circuitry, so that they required little supervision for routine tasks, such as housework." Madame shook her head slowly.
"So close to humanity, and yet so far away from us. Their lifespan is only 14 or 15 years in captivity. Probably less in the wild. So fragile. So helpless-seeming. How did they ever survive the hyenas, the bear dogs, the saber-toothed cats, and other monsters?"
"Brains," Richard said. "Look at the one who came to us. Her family won't be hungry tonight. There's natural selection working right in front of us. That little ape is a survivor."
Felice looked at him with a wicked expression.
"I thought I noticed a family resemblance. Here you go, Captain Blood. Have some of your great-great-et-cetera grandmother's fruit for dessert."
They left the Danube behind them and walked. It felt like the temperature was over 40 in the September sun, but their adapted bodies could take it. Over the sunburnt grass, through thickets of brittle maquis,
Over boulders in the dry watercourses they walked. Richard had set their goal, the notch between two long hills that lay due north beyond slowly rising land, with hardly a patch of shade and no water at all. They stripped to shorts, backpacks, and broad-brimmed hats. Madame passed a precious squeeze bottle of sunburn cream. Richard led, and Felice took the rear, the athlete ranging out tirelessly to be sure that no animal stalked them, and to search, without luck as it turned out, for some spring or other source of water. Between the two marched Claude and Madame, supporting Martha between them. The engineer became weaker as the hot hours of hiking accumulated, but she refused to let them slow down. None of them wanted to stop, in spite of the fact that there seemed to be nothing ahead of them but the dry, stubbly upland reaching to the undulating horizon. Above it hung a pale yellow, pitiless sky. At last, the sun dropped low, and the sky turned to a light green. Madame called a halt near a rock-choked ravine, where they could at least relieve themselves in privacy. Madame led Martha off, and when the two returned, the old woman's face was grim.
"She is hemorrhaging again," she told Claude. "Shall we stop here, or shall we make again a litter from one of the cots?"
They decided upon the litter. While there was still daylight, they wanted to press on. Just a few kilometers farther, and they would reach the brow of the hills. They continued on as they had done earlier in the journey, one at each corner of the modified cot. Martha lay with her lower lip clamped between her teeth, twin spots of bright rose on her pale cheeks, the badges of her mortification. But she said nothing. The heavens turned to ultramarine, and then to indigo, and the first stars appeared. However, they could still see well enough to walk, and so they kept going, higher and higher, close to the notch. At last, they were at the summit. The four of them set the litter down and helped Martha to her feet so that she could stand with them and look northward. About 5 kilometers away, and just slightly below the pass where they rested, was a long rampart. It reared up from the countryside behind the line of hills in a virtual jungle of spiny mesquite scrub, and curved away on both sides in a great arc that eventually melted into the northern horizon. The bare lip of the crater gleamed pale in the dusk. Felice took Richard's head between her hands and kissed his mouth, standing on tiptoe.
"You did it. Right on the nose, buccaneer baby, you did it."
"Well, I'll be damned," said the pirate.
"I don't think so."
Claude's broad Slavic face wore an exultant smile.
"Oh, madame. The ship's grave!"
Martha's voice broke. Her eyes spilled tears.
"And now? Now?"
"Now we will make camp," the Frenchwoman said practically. "We will rest well and recover our strength for tomorrow. Our work really begins."
The skeleton had been laid out in state in the belly compartment of the fifth flyer that they inspected. Unlike the other craft, which had had their hatches closed, the sepulchre of Lagon was wide open to the elements. For long years, the mammals, birds, and insects of the Maquis had made free with it. Felice had, as always, been first up the boarding ladder of the exotic craft. Her cry of triumph at finally finding the remains of the Tanu hero was followed by a tortured howl that raised the neck hairs of the other four members of the expedition.
"He has no torque! No torque!"
"Angelique," Claude shouted in alarm, "reach out and stop her doing any harm in there."
"No torque!"
A shriek of diabolic rage echoed within the flying machine, and there was a thudding sound. As Richard and Claude clambered up the ladder, Madame Gudrian stood beneath the shadow of the metal bird's wings, eyes wide, mouth drawn into a strained grimace, both hands clenching the gold at her throat. It took every bit of her coercive metafunction to restrain Felice, to force the girl to back off from the instinctive urge to destroy the source of her frustration. Driven by furious disappointment, the athlete's latencies trembled on the brink of operancy. The old woman felt her own ultra-senses being tested to the limit. She held, pressed the volcanic thing that writhed within her mind grasp, while at the same time her telepathic voice cried, "Wait, wait! We will all search. Wait." Felice let go her opposition so abruptly
that Madame Guderian staggered backward and collapsed into Martha's frail arms.
"Okay," Richard shouted from above. "I popped her one. She's out cold."
"But did she ruin anything?" Martha called, easing Madame to the dusty ground.
"Doesn't look like it," Richard replied. "Get up here, Marty, and have a look at this frigger yourself, like something out of a goddamn fairy tale."
Felice lay in a heap on the far side of the flyer's belly compartment, which measured about 3x6. She had managed to seize Lagan's helmeted skull and dash it to the deck in a paroxysm of rage. But the interior of the ancient craft was so deep in dust, animal droppings, and other organic trash that the relic had come to no harm. Claude knelt down and restored the head to its place. Resting on his haunches, he studied the legend laid out before him. Lugan's armor, heavily jeweled and filmed with gold, was now so dimmed and crusted that his bones could barely be discerned within the articulated plates and scales of glass. The crystalline helmet, crested with a peculiar heraldic animal, was a baroque and incredibly intricate piece of craftsmanship, so gorgeous, even coated with grime, that one forgot that it had a utilitarian purpose to deflect photonic beams. Carefully, Claude raised the visor and unfastened the overlapping gorget plates and hinged cheek pieces. Lugan's skull was mutilated by a great wound, perfectly circular, and a full 12 centimeters in diameter, which drilled through the naso-orbital region and obliterated the rear of the skull opposite the eyes. "So that much of the tale was true," the old man murmured. He could not resist inspecting the skull for non-human attributes. Most of the differences were subtle, but the Tano had possessed only 30 teeth, and he had been notably long-headed as well as massively built. Aside from anomalies in the positions of some cranial sutures and the mental foramina, the Tano skull seemed almost completely humanoid. Richard stared about the compartment, noting the adobe wasp nests that crusted almost every surface, the shredded bulkhead insulation, the exposed ceram framework of once luxurious cabin appointments. There was even a beehive in one of the open forward lockers.
"Well, we don't have a prayer of getting this sucker off the ground. We'll have to go back to one of the others."
Martha was digging in the mounds of rubbish on the left side of the skeleton in armor. She gave a satisfied cry.
"Look here. Help me get it out of the garbage, Richard."
"The spear."
He helped her push away the moldy mess. In a few minutes, the two of them had laid bare a slender instrument nearly a meter taller than the great skeleton, connected by a cable near the butt to a large jeweled box that had once been worn at Lugan's waist. The box straps had now disintegrated, but the glassy surface of the box and the spear itself did not seem to be corroded. Martha wiped hands on hips.
"That's it, all right. Zephyr and Power Pack. Careful of those studs there on the upper armrest, lovey. Even crudded up as they are, they might still trigger the thing."
"But how?" Claude marveled softly. "How did he ever pull the trigger on himself?"
"Oh, for Christ's sake," said Richard. "Forget that, and help us get the thing outside before our little butch Goldilocks wakes up and goes bonkers again."
"I am awake," Felice said. She massaged the point of her chin, where a bruise was forming.
"I'm sorry about that. I won't lose control again. And no hard feelings for the love tap, Captain Blood."
Madame Guderian came slowly up the boarding ladder. Her eyes rested briefly on the glass-armored skeleton, and then passed to Felice.
"Oh, ma petite, what are we going to do with you?"
A sadness weighted her voice. The girl got up and displayed a gamine grin.
"I didn't really spoil anything with my little temper fit, and I guarantee it won't happen again. Let's forget it."
She prowled about the flyer interior, kicking at the trash.
"I expect the Torque's around here someplace. Maybe some critter carried it away from the skeleton and stashed it in another part of the ship."
Claude took up the pack and started to descend the ladder, while Richard and Martha followed with the still-tethered weapon, not wanting to risk disconnecting the cable. Madame regarded the skeleton.
"So here you lie, shining Lugan. Dead before the adventures of your exiled people had scarcely begun. Your tomb defiled by the little vermin of Earth.
and now by us.
Shaking her head, she turned to descend the ladder. Felice sprang to the old woman's assistance.
I've a wonderful idea, madame. I won't be any use working on the aircraft or the spear. So when I'm not needed for camp chores or hunting, I'll come back here and clean this place out. I'll make it all neat again and polish his golden glass armor. And when we leave, we can close the hatch.
Yes, Madame Gudrian nodded.
It would be a fitting work. I'd have to move all this rubbish anyway, Felice added, when I was looking for the torque. It must be here somewhere. No Tano or Fearvalad would have dared to take it. I know I'll find it.
Standing on the ground now, Madame looked up at Felice.
So small, so winsome, so dangerous.
Perhaps you will. But if you don't, what then?
The girl was calm.
Why, then I'll have to hold King Yochi to his promise, that's all.
Richard said,
How about getting down here and giving us a hand, kid? You can moon around with your ancient astronaut all you want when we get a work camp set up. Come on, we're going to move back to the last bird in line. See if you can carry this whole spear rig by yourself, will you? She's an awkward bitch for a two-man tote.
Felice dropped lightly down from the belly hatch, hoisted the 80-kilo power pack in one arm, and stood while Claude and Richard balanced the long weapon on her opposite shoulder.
I can manage, she said, but God knows how that old boy ever used this gadget in a running fight. He must have been quite a lad. Just wait till I find his torque.
Claude and Madame looked at each other wordlessly for a moment, then helped Martha gather up their things. They began the half-kilometer trudge back along the crater lip to the number 4 aircraft. Madame said,
We have been fortunate finding the spear so readily, but there is another factor that may preclude an attack on Fenaya this year.
And that is, Claude inquired,
the matter of who shall fly the ancient craft during the actual firefight.
She looked back over her shoulder at Richard, who was supporting Martha.
You will recall that he agreed merely to fly the machine back to the Vosges. If we must train another pilot for the battle...
Martha had heard every word, of course. She turned to the ex-spacer with a stricken expression. Richard gave a terse little bark of laughter.
Madame, you prove it again and again. You're no mind reader. Do you really think I'd miss our little war?
Martha clutched him tighter and whispered something to him. Madame said nothing, but as she turned away from them to resume the march along the rim trail, she smiled.
After a while, Richard said,
There's something else we ought to think about, though. Wouldn't it be best if we concentrate first on fixing up the flyer and hold off on the spear until we get back home? Today is September 22nd, and the little king said that the truce begins on October 1st. We're cutting things damn short if the spooks are going to need a week to mobilize. And what about getting your people ready, madame? And working out the tactics for the iron weapons, if they got 'em? Seems to me the faster we get out of here, the more time will be left for organizing. And back at your village, Martha can get proper medical care from Amari. Maybe somebody like Khalid Khan could help out with the spear repairs, too.
It was Martha who demurred. Don't forget we've got to test the spear. We must get it working, then install it in the aircraft somehow and try it out from the air. If the zapper is as powerful as I think it is, every Tana with a microgram of Farsense would be able to detect its atmospherics if we shot it off within 100 kilometers of the Vosges.
God, yes, Richard said, crestfallen. I forgot about that.
Madame said, We must do the best we can to put both flyer and spear in working order before we leave this place. As for those back home, we will trust Pio to have everything in readiness. He knows every nuance of the plan against Fenaya. If we have even one day remaining before the start of the truce, we will still mount the attack.
Well, let's get hopping then, Felice said. She broke into a brisk trot, leaving the rest of them straggling far behind. They saw her wave at them briefly from the vicinity of the neighboring flyer, then vanish down the outside of the crater into the scrub.
When they reached the great metal bird, they found the spear placed carefully in the shadow of its wings. Beside it, scratched in the dust, was a message. Gone hunting.
For what? Richard wondered cynically.
Then he and Martha climbed up the ladder of the undisturbed aircraft,
opened the simple hatch lock, and disappeared inside. 8. It took 3 days to get the flyer airborne. Richard had known that these exotic crafts were gravomagnetic the moment he had looked inside the first specimen. The flight deck and passenger compartment of the 30-meter bird had simple, easy seats, not acceleration couches, ergo, inertialess drive, the universal propulsion system for aircraft and subliminal spaceships of the galactic milieu, which enabled almost instantaneous acceleration or deceleration in apparent defiance of gravity inertia. The odds seemed good that the exotics had tapped the key forces of the universe in much the same cable car fashion as the engineers of the milieu. Richard and Martha had warily opened one of the 16 power modules of what they hoped was the flux tap generator, using the flyer's own tools. They found, to their relief, that the liquid within was water, no matter that the thingamies generating the row field reticula were concentric spheres within spheres, instead of the stacked crystalline blades of the analogous milieu device. The principle and the basic operation had to be the same. When the generator was fueled with good old aqua pura, this exotic bird would very likely go. Claude rigged up a still and tended the ever-bubbling decimal pot while Richard and Martha traced the control circuitry and made sense of the quaint in-ship environmental system, which was capable of recharging itself once they got a little water into the power plant. After one day of fiddling with the alien controls, Richard felt confident enough to carry on with the analysis alone, letting Martha transfer her efforts to the sphere. For safety's sake, on the off chance that the flyer might blow during one of the ground slide tests, they transferred the work camp to a shelf-like clearing in the McKee several kilometers downslope from the aircraft, where a spring gushed through the crater wall. On the evening of the third day, as they gathered around the campfire, Richard announced that the ancient machine was ready for its first flight test. "I've scraped most of the lichen off and dug all the bird and bug nests out of the vents. She seems damn near good as new for all her 1,000 years of squatting."
"How about the controls?" Claude asked. "Are you sure you figured them out?"
"I turned off all the audibles, of course, since they weren't speaking my language, but the flight instrumentation is mostly graphic, so I can get by. Can't read the altimeter, but there's a terrain clearance and position monitor that shows a nice picture. And eyeballs were made before digitals, anyhow. Numeral-wise, the engine cluster is hopeless, but each reader is equipped with 3 idiot lights, cyan, amber, and violet, for go, watch it, and bye-bye. So I should do all right there, too. My big problem is going to be the wings. Putting wings on a Gravomag aircraft is weird. They must be a cultural relic. Maybe these folks just enjoyed gliding."
"Richard," Martha said breathlessly, "take me with you tomorrow."
"Oh, Marty, babe," he began. Madame intervened.
"You may not, Martha. There is a risk, even though Richard is confident."
"She's right," he said, taking Martha's hand. It was cold, in spite of the warm evening. The firelight threw cruel shadows on the engineer's sunken cheeks and eyes. "Once I've checked her out, then we'll go for a spin, promise. We can't let anything happen to you, kid. Who'd put that damn zapper back together?" Martha moved closer to Richard and stared into the fire.
"I think the spear will work. The power pack shows half charge, which is really remarkable. And none of the tiny little internal components of the Lance unit seem to have been damaged. The main difficulties have been cleaning out the barrel and replacing the chewed-up cable. It was lucky that the flyer had some stuff that seemed compatible. I'll need one more day to finish and reassemble, and then we can test it and begin practice."
"How powerful do you think it will be?" Claude asked.
"There are several options, I believe," the engineer said. "The lowest setting is the only one lacking a cap lock, so they might have used that for their ritual fighting. I'd guess its power to be within light pistol range. The 4 higher settings under the lock must have been for special purposes. At the top of the line, we could have us a portable photon cannon."
Richard whistled.
"I don't think we dare test it on Max unless we want to risk draining the power pack," Martha said.
"No chance of recharging?" asked Richard.
"I can't get the pack open," she admitted. "It takes a special tool, and I was afraid to cark around with it. We'll just have to save our big zap for the war."
The gnarled branches of the McKee burned with a pungent, resinous odor, snapping and throwing sparks that had to be smacked out. Only a few insects buzzed in the drought-stricken jungle. When it was full dark, the remaining birds and small mammals in the area would come to the spring to drink, and Felice and her beau would glean food for tomorrow. The blonde athlete said,
"I have Lugan's place nearly clean now. There's no sign of the torque."
Only Martha was able to voice a regret. Richard said, "Should be plenty of the things lying around if we make good at Fenaya. You won't have to beg the little king for one, just reach down on the battlefield and grab."
"Yes," sighed Felice.
"How have you planned to mount the spear, Richard?" Claude asked. "I can't see how we could rig up a pilot-operated trigger given the short time we have left."
"There's really only one way to handle it. I hover the aircraft and somebody else shoots the zapper out of the open belly hatch. I suppose we could trust one of Chief Burke's bully boys to..."
The old man said softly,
"Every exopaleontologist knows how to handle big zappers. How do you think we cut the rocks to get the specimens out? I've carved up a few cliffs in my day, even moved a mountain now and then to get at some really choice fossils."
Richard chortled.
"I'll be damned. Okay, you're hired. We'll be a two-man crew."
"Three," said Madame. "You will need me to provide a metapsychic screen for the flyer."
"Angelique," Claude protested.
"There is no helping it," she said. "Beltane and his flying hunt would see you hovering there."
"You're not going," the old man stormed. "Not a chance. We'll come over Fenaya at high altitude, then drop down vertically and take them by surprise."
"You won't," Madame was implacable. "They will detect you hovering. We can only hope to surprise them if I can seal the vessel metapsychically during its initial maneuvers. I must go. There's nothing more to be said."
Claude got to his feet and stood hulking over her.
"The hell there isn't. Do you think I'd let you fly into the middle of a firefight? Richard and I have one chance in 100 of getting out with whole skins. We're going to need every grain of concentration to do the job and then get out. We can't afford to be worrying about you."
"Ha! Worry about yourself, Radoter. Who is the leader of this group? C'est moi. Whose plan is it, de toute façon, for the entire attack? Mine. I go."